This is Mark Lemley from Stanford Law School, and you're listening to IP Fridays.
Jingle bells, jingle bells, jingle all
the way. Hello, happy holidays, and welcome to this episode of IP Fridays. Our names are Ken Suzanne and Rolf Clayson, and this is the podcast dedicated to intellectual property. It does not matter where you are from, in-house or private practice, novice or expert. We will help you stay up to date with current topics in the fields of trademarks, patents, design and copyright, discover useful tools, and much more. Both Rolf and I are very happy that you have decided to tune into our podcast today. The response to our joint efforts have been remarkable, and we look forward to sharing IP news, interviews, and developments with you in the coming new year. To celebrate this holiday season, we invite you to leave us voicemail by clicking on the button on the right side of our website at ipfridays.com, or use the feedback page to leave us a comment at ipfridays.com/feedback. Following a random drawing of names, we will choose and announce a total of 3 winners who will receive complimentary Christmas mugs from an authentic German Christmas market in Cologne, Germany, Rolf's hometown. We will take care of shipping no matter where you may be. Make sure to note your email address so we can get in contact with you should you win. We encourage you to stay in touch with us so we get to know you as our listeners. Also, feel free to note any topics or recommended interview guests that would be a good fit for our program. From Cologne, Germany to Minneapolis, Minnesota, and all points in between and worldwide, we wish you and yours a wonderful holiday season and Happy New Year.
Just hear those sleigh bells jingling, ring-ting-tingling too.
Today is Friday, the 26th of December, and you are listening to the Christmas edition of IP Fridays. I hope you enjoyed the introductory music, and I hope you will enjoy the Christmas music in the end of this edition of IP Fridays. We have a very special treat for you today. We have, in fact, 2 interviews for you. The first interview will be Jordan Weinstein of Barnes & Thornburg. And as a second guest for this episode, we have Adrian Dayton, who is an attorney and now specializes in teaching attorneys how to use social media, and in particular LinkedIn and Twitter. But before we head into the interviews, I just want to let you know that we are giving away 3 really beautiful mugs from a German Christmas market. A picture can be seen in the show notes. So if you want to win one of these mugs, you simply have to comment on our podcast, any of the episodes, or in the general feedback form, or leave us a voicemail at ipfridays.com/voicemail, and make sure you mention your email address so we can get in touch with you. So now it's time for our first interview. Ken, you had the chance to interview Jordan Weinstein.
Thank you, Rolf. Today I'm joined by Jordan Weinstein. He is a partner in Barnes & Thornburg's Washington, D.C. office and a member of the firm's intellectual property department. Jordan has a number of professional affiliations locally and nationally. He is a member of the International Trademark Association's editorial board for the Trademark Reporter and was co-chair of the association's annual meeting in Washington, D.C. He's former co-chair of the American Bar Association's Trademarks and the Internet Committee, and a member of the association's Intellectual Property Law Practice Management Sections. Welcome, Jordan, to our program.
Thank you, Ken, and happy Trademark Week to you.
That's right. Why are we calling this Trademark Week at the Supreme Court?
Well, Ken, for the first time in history, the Supreme Court is hearing 2 trademark cases on days back-to-back. So they just heard one yesterday, December 2nd, and are hearing another one. And in fact, not only had they heard that case already today, December 3rd, while we speak, but the transcript has already been uploaded to the Supreme Court's website.
Oh, fascinating. And what are the main issues before the court?
Well, the Supreme Court has considered 2 procedural issues. One with far-reaching consequences for people who practice before the Trademark Trial and Appeal Board, and the other with more esoteric but still important consequences for those with older trademarks.
Mm-hmm.
The, The first case asks whether the Trademark Trial and Appeal Board's finding of likelihood of confusion in opposition or cancellation cases can be issue preclusive. In other words, can it have collateral estoppel effect on a federal district court that's looking at likelihood of confusion in infringement proceedings?
Mm-hmm.
The second case asks whether trademark tacking is a question of fact for a jury or a question of law for a judge. And obviously, there'll be lots more on that in a little while.
Yeah, so tell us about the issue preclusion case. What is the caption and what is issue preclusion?
Okay, so first of all, our case that was heard yesterday, December 2nd, was B&B Hardware Incorporated versus Hargis Industries, Inc. It was an appeal from the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals and concerned issue preclusion of the Trademark Trial and Appeal Board's decision that the two parties' marks, Seal-Tite for building fasteners and Seal-Tite in the aeronautical industry, would be likely to cause confusion.
Mm-hmm.
Now, let's go back for a second, Ken. Issue preclusion is where a party that litigates an issue to a final decision is then precluded from litigating that same issue, not necessarily the same claim, but the same issue, against the same party in a later case. There are five elements necessary for issue preclusion to apply. First, the party sought to be precluded must have been a party or in privity with a party to the original suit. Second, the issue sought to be precluded must be the same as the issue involved in the prior action here before the Trademark Trial and Appeal Board. Third, that issue must actually have been litigated in the prior action. Fourth, the issue must have been determined by a valid and final judgment. And then fifth, the determination of that issue must have been essential to the prior judgment.
So there's a definite test there that the courts look at.
Absolutely. And the manner of the test and how it's applied is really not in dispute here.
Mm-hmm.
The question is whether preclusion should be applied at all to board proceedings by federal district courts that are deciding infringement, not as an appeal from the Trademark Trial and Appeal Board, but in a separate infringement action.
And so in this case, what's the background? What brought the parties up to the court?
Well, the petitioner here, B&B, makes and sells a fastener product that, as I mentioned, is called Seal-Tite,
mm-hmm.
and it's used predominantly in the aerospace industry.
Okay.
Hargis, the respondent, makes a line of self-drilling and self-taping screws that it calls Seal-Tite. Now, really, the difference between the marks is that B&B spells its mark Seal-Tite, T-I-G-H-T,
mm-hmm.
and Hargis spells its mark Seal-Tite, T-I-T-E.
But the pronunciation is the same, Jordan?
As far as we know, the pronunciation is the same, and neither of the parties were arguing that the pronunciation would be different.
Okay.
There is some testimony that Hargis uses its mark as Seal-Tite building fasteners, but that's a little bit too involved for the moment.
Sure.
I can get into that a little bit later.
Sure. Now, the parties' positions, what could you tell our listeners what they both are in a short and succinct way?
Well, there is a good bit of history here that I'll need for background as to why the listeners might be interested to know, are we talking about preclusion at all?
Sure.
Back in 1996, Hargis filed an application for its Seal-Tite mark for its self-drilling and self-taping screws. B&B sued Hargis for trademark infringement, and a jury found for Hargis and against trademark infringement in 2000.
Mm-hmm.
But the basis of that decision was not based on likelihood of confusion or no likelihood of confusion. It was based on the fact that the jury found B&B's mark to be descriptive. Well, Hargis then turned around and petitioned to cancel B&B's registration on that same grounds. The board first granted that petition and then reversed on reconsideration because the petition was filed after the registration became incontestable.
Uh-huh.
And it was too late for Hargis to petition.
Sure.
So before the reconsideration was decided and when the petition had been granted, Hargis's own mark was published for opposition, and B&B opposed that.
Mm-hmm.
In 2007, The board found that there was a likelihood of confusion based on B&B's statutory rights. Remember, its common law mark had been found descriptive, but its federal registration could not be canceled. It was too late. But at any rate, the board in that decision found that there was likelihood of confusion between the two marks. It denied Hargis's registration, and Hargis did not appeal the board's decision. That's an important fact. B&B then turned around and sued Hargis for trademark infringement based upon its federal registration. B&B asked the trial court to have the Trademark Trial and Appeal Board's decision on likelihood of confusion preclude any further litigation on that issue because it had already been litigated and decided by the board.
Sure.
The district court refused to grant that motion and also refused to admit the board's decision even into evidence, so the jury never saw it, as the trial court thought it would mislead the jury. The jury eventually found for Hargis, finding that when the marks were used on the respective goods of the parties in their respective purchasing environments, confusion would not be likely. So then we move, of course, up to the Eighth Circuit.
Yes.
The Eighth Circuit affirmed on both of those issues. It refused to grant the board's decision any preclusive effect, and it affirmed the jury decision of no likelihood of confusion.
So what do you think, Jordan, will be the outcome here when the court issues its decision?
Well, before the board, we have some competing arguments. Before the Supreme Court, we have competing arguments. On the petitioner's side, the Trademark Trial and Appeal Board and the federal court, petitioner believes, were considering the same issue. The Lanham Act doesn't draw any distinction between likelihood of confusion for registration and likelihood of confusion for infringement. The parties had litigated the same marks on the same goods and the same theories before the board as they did at trial. The Eighth Circuit might have disagreed with the balance that the board struck in comparing the mark and evaluating the market. But under the law of judgments, issue preclusion should apply when the question has already been answered, and it doesn't matter whether you like the answer or not. The respondent countered to that although the likelihood of confusion tests appear to be similar, on close inspection of the statute, they're actually different. When it comes to registration, the Trademark Trial and Appeal Board is determining whether a mark so resembles another mark as to be likely to cause confusion, whereas for infringement, the respondent argues that it's the mark's actual use in commerce that's at issue. The respondent says that the board's decision is not binding on U.S. District or Article III courts because the board and the courts serve different purposes and decide different rights. Board proceedings decide the right to register, and court proceedings include the full procedures of civil litigation and determine the right to use a mark.
So essentially, there's two different things going on, or is it two different worlds or not? As you compare the two.
Well, my take is that in a way there are two different worlds. Because the board deals only with the right to register a trademark, it answers the question of likelihood of confusion by examining the mark as it appears in the application. If a mark is actually used with a design, but that design doesn't appear in the application, the board can't really consider it. If there are trade channels that are limited in actual use, but they're not limited in the application, the board can't consider those limitations. If prospective purchasers are sophisticated, the board can't consider that fact unless the goods are of a type purchased only by those sophisticated purchasers or it's actually listed in the application. So as a result, even if the board considers all the 13 DuPont factors, those are the factors of confusion or likelihood of confusion that the board considers in oppositions and cancellations, often it must ignore those limitations if the application doesn't include them.
So, practically speaking, what do you think the outcome of this case would mean for brand owners once we have the decision on the books?
Well, I think the stars really need to align to create the exact scenario at issue here or to recreate it.
Yes.
You'd have to have a losing party that chooses not to appeal the board's decision on registration. And then the parties litigate likelihood of confusion in a whole separate court action where the board's decision is not at issue. Mm-hmm. Often what happens, Ken, is that the losing party appeals the board's decision to a trial court that will consider the evidence de novo and often before a jury. And then the other party will add a claim to decide the question of infringement on top of the question of the right to registration. Or the other thing that happens is that one party will concurrently to the board proceeding bring a court action, and they'll request the board then to suspend its own proceedings, which the board does almost as a matter of course.
Sure.
And in neither of those situations would the issue of preclusion ever arise.
Can you tell us, there's another case I know that is before the court, and that's a tacking case. What's the caption for that case, and tell me about tacking?
That case is Hanna Financial versus Hanna Bank. Actually, that's the Ninth Circuit Court's caption. It's Hanna Bank versus Hanna Financial before the Supreme Court. And again, this case involves trademark tacking, which is the right to modify or update your trademark without losing its priority of use date. As we know in trademarks, first in time is first in right. And a federal registration merely serves as notice to the world of what that first date is because it's listed right in the registration. But a brand owner should not have to lose rights in a long-established mark simply because it updates that mark slightly. For example, if you remember the Morton Salt label, there's a girl holding an umbrella with a container of salt spilling out.
Mm-hmm.
Over the years, Morton has updated that logo to show to change the girl's haircut to look more modern, to make her dress a little bit more updated. And all of those times, Morton has retained its right because the commercial impression of that mark has never changed. But a brand owner should not be able to introduce a mark with a different commercial impression and then be able to backdate that to the older and different mark's first use date.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because the Federal Register of Trademarks really serves a notice function. And that function would not be served if a registrant can materially change the mark yet keep its own registration rights.
Mm-hmm. And in this case, what happened with the parties? Why are they in litigation?
So what happened between these parties is Hanna Bank, back in 1994, adopted a mark, Hanna Overseas Korean Club, offering financial services to Korean expatriates living in the U.S. They published newspaper ads with the name Hanna Overseas Korean Club in English, and the name Hanna Bank in Korean letters with what they call a dancing man logo. The next year, the respondent, Hanna Financial, I'll just call them Financial just for purposes
sure.
to keep them straight.
That's right.
They adopted their name, Hanna Financial, in connection with factoring and other financial services. In 96, Financial obtained their own federal registration for Hanna Financial. In 2000, Hanna Bank changed its name from Hanna Overseas Korean Club to Hanna World Center. They tried to register Hanna World Center, but their application was refused. In 2007, Financial filed suit against Hanna Bank for trademark infringement and related claims. Hanna Bank counterclaimed to cancel Financial's federal registration. Financial sought to exclude Hanna Bank's 1994 advertisements for Hanna Overseas Korean Club and Hanna Bank in Korean, arguing that those advertisements were irrelevant. Financial asserted that the marks were not virtually identical, and therefore it would be improper to tack the earlier mark that appeared in those advertisements onto the later mark, Hanna Bank, for purposes of establishing priority all the way from today back to 1994.
Mm-hmm.
That motion, the motion to preclude the advertisements from coming into evidence, was denied. The jury then found that Hanna Bank had used its mark in commerce in the U.S., beginning prior to April 1, 1995, Financial moved for judgment as a matter of law and lost, and Hanna Bank, or Financial appealed to the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals. Now, at that point, the Eighth Circuit comes up with, and as I mentioned, this is kind of an esoteric case, a discussion of the standard of review that really is important to understanding the outcome here. In the Eighth Circuit, they consider the question of whether two marks are sufficiently similar for tacking to be a question of fact. And as a question of fact, a verdict of tacking will be upheld if it is supported by substantial evidence, even if it would be possible to draw a contrary conclusion from that evidence. But for now, the court found that although the evidence could be construed to support Financial's position, that wasn't enough. The court couldn't set aside the judgment if Financial could not show that its interpretation of the evidence is the only possible one.
Mm-hmm.
So the court noted that other circuits view tacking as a question of law. Those same circuits also happen to view likelihood of confusion as a question of law. And in those circuits, the Eighth Circuit noted, a different conclusion might be reached. And this was because a question of law would have been reviewed de novo by the circuit court with no substantial evidence standard to meet. And the appeals court could substitute its judgment for that of the district court. And guess what? That's exactly what Financial is asking the court to be able to do.
Sure. So the question of law, question of fact, it comes down to, you know, which road do we take?
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
So in seeking cert to the Supreme Court, Financial noted this split in the circuits as to whether tacking was a question of fact or question of law.
Mm-hmm.
And in their main brief, of course, they assert that tacking should be a question for the judge to resolve, because the question posed by tacking, whether two marks are legal equivalents, is, they say, by definition, a legal question. It should be resolved by resort to legal precedent and not to facts. And the proof of that is in the result of this case, they say. If a court were to apply the correct legal standard, they would not have reached what they call the perverse result of considering Hana Overseas Korean Club, Hana Financial Center, and Hana Bank to be legal equivalents.
Mm-hmm.
Tacking questions, they say, are historically resolved by comparing two marks against those addressed in other tacking cases and determining whether those marks at issue more closely resemble circumstances in which tacking was permitted or resemble cases in which tacking was rejected. Financial believes that a jury is not capable of making that determination because a jury works in isolation, quite literally.
Yes.
It lacks the information and experience needed to place particular marks in the context of a wider legal universe, and they typically have no knowledge of the treatment that have been accorded comparable marks in the past. Hana Bank argued that tacking is an issue of fact that considers whether two marks convey a continuing commercial impression. That requires a subjective assessment of the trademark's respective impressions on the relevant consumers. Unsurprisingly, Hana Bank argues that tacking is an inquiry best suited for a jury. Assessing public perception suits jurors best because they reflect community standards better than a single judge in the judge's ivory tower. Assessing consumer perception is not something judges often do, or something that they do better than jurors, or something that requires specialized legal training. Hana Bank argues that the Financial's argument about tacking being a legal test relies solely on the presence of that word legal in the legal equivalence test. But really all that is, says Hana Bank, is a conclusion that you draw after you apply the factual tacking test, whether the two marks convey the same continuing commercial impression. Now, functional considerations really support treating tacking as a factual issue, says Hana Bank, and I tend to agree with them here.
Okay.
Tacking involves a comparison of the trademark's respective impressions on ordinary consumers, just like likelihood of confusion requires a determination of consumers' potential misimpressions of a trademark. A jury panel provides a broader perspective and better represents average consumers than a single judge, so the jury really is better suited to evaluate the issue of consumer impression.
Does this issue come up a lot for, in cases that you handle? Have you seen this come up over the many years of your practice?
I have seen it come up occasionally, but just occasionally. It's mm-hmm. It's not that often that one of these cases arise, but obviously, it's something that the owner of an older, venerable brand needs to keep in mind.
Sure.
Because when it comes time to freshen or update, a legacy trademark, one will want to be aware that they either want to be able to amass all of this evidence and keep that in their back pocket the next time they're going to have a litigation so that that can be brought up before a jury, or are they going to be cautious about modifying their trademark because they know that it's going to be up to a judge and they're going to have to get probably a legal opinion as to whether that modification is going to make sense for them in order to maintain their rights.
It's definitely something you really have to consider and think carefully about before you start making changes to your mark.
Absolutely, and obviously we'll have more guidance for trademark owners and the lawyers that represent them when the Supreme Court hands down its decision.
And what do you think the court's going to say?
My belief is that the court will come down on the side of this being a jury issue, mostly because it is so akin to the likelihood of confusion issue.
Mm-hmm.
This is a consumer perception issue, and really the best judges of consumer perception are the ones that are closest to being consumers.
Yeah, I agree with you on that as well. Do you think, Jordan, there was a reason why these two cases were scheduled to be heard back-to-back here in early December 2014?
Well, I guess one reason that the court might have wanted to schedule these two cases back-to-back is so that the justices don't have to refresh themselves twice on the arcana of trademark administration and trial court practice.
Interesting.
But I do think that the cases also do have a couple of unifying themes. In both cases, the effect of granting the appeal would be to nullify a jury verdict, or actually in the case of B&B, it would be to nullify two jury verdicts. And the effect for future cases would be to keep these particular issues from the jury.
Mm-hmm.
A second theme is that both cases revolve around whether the issue can be resolved in each case by a mere comparison of the marks, or whether the marks must be compared in their purchasing environments. In Hanna, that is the difference between the parties' position. In B&B, one of the sides argues that the Trademark Trial and Appeal Board's decision is limited to a comparison of the marks, they so closely resembles test,
mm-hmm.
while the other side argues that the board compares, or at least can compare, the marks as they are used. But interestingly, back to back, each petitioner is arguing for the opposite type of review. Hanna obviously wants the petitioner wants the judge to compare the marks alone, and in B&B, the petitioner asserts the board should review the marks by comparing the way they're actually used and not just in the abstract.
Excellent. Jordan, it's not often that we have two trademark cases in the same week, right?
Not only is it not often, but it may be a first ever for the Supreme Court.
Wow.
So that's fun for us, and it brings us kind of back to where we started. The Supreme Court's decision in B&B might have long-term effects on how parties to Trademark Trial and Appeal Boards conduct those proceedings, and even on how they choose to apply for trademarks. And although the Hanna Bank decision is unlikely to be have such wide-ranging repercussions, it will still be important to any mark owner that wants to update its mark.
Thank you very much, Jordan.
If you want to find out more about Jordan, please go to ipfridays.com/Jordan, J-O-R-D-A-N. Ken also had the chance to interview Adrian Dayton, who has switched to teaching attorneys about Twitter and LinkedIn. So here's the interview for you.
Ralph, I am joined today by Adrian Dayton, who lives and works out of Buffalo, New York. Adrian is an internationally recognized speaker on social media and business development. He writes a weekly column on social media for the National Law Journal and is the author of two books, LinkedIn and Blogs for Lawyers, Building High-Value Relationships in a Digital Age, and Social Media for Lawyers, Twitter Edition. He is also the founder of Clearview Social, a new social media tool built for attorneys. His consulting business, Adrian Dayton & Associates, has been engaged for the last 3 years with Global 100, AmLaw 250, Canadian and Australian firms, helping them to increase profitability through effective use of digital media. His most popular programs include LinkedIn training, law firm retreats, law blog strategy, group coaching, social media audits, and implementation. Adrian, welcome to the program.
Hey, thank you so much, Ken. Thrilled to be on.
Excellent. So, Adrian, tell me a little bit about your business and what you're doing these days.
Yeah, great. Well, so I guess I need to kind of start at the beginning. I started out as a practicing lawyer doing M&A work in Western New York. And then one day the economic downturn hit. And at the same time, I discovered social media. So I actually brought in my first client through Twitter. And so I was thinking, wow, you know, nobody knows about Twitter, but it's a really powerful tool. Mm-hmm. I wonder if I could start a business to help lawyers use social media. And then one day, the head of my department came into my office, and he shared with me a few words I'll never forget. He said, "You're fired." Well, you know, he had to let me go. With the downturn, there was no work. And so I called my wife, and I said, "Honey, you know, I lost my job." And she was crying, and I said, "But it's okay, because I'm going to start a new business teaching lawyers how to use Twitter." And of course, then she just cried harder. But
wow.
Anyway, she was actually very supportive. And over the next few months, I wrote the first book, my first book on social media for lawyers. And then social media exploded. And I was in the right place at the right time. A few months later, I was hired by my first Am Law 100 firm.
Mm-hmm.
And that was kind of the first domino. I've done work for that firm for the last 5 years, but I've also had the chance to work with over a dozen Am Law 100 firms and some of the largest law firms in the world. Just earlier this year, we recognized one big problem organizations had is that they could teach their lawyers to use social media, but often they wouldn't engage. They wouldn't get online and share or talk or do anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so back in February, I launched a software company called Clearview Social. And maybe we'll have time to talk about that later, but basically it's a software that makes it very easy for firms to get their lawyers sharing on LinkedIn and to the other social networks.
And how have you found the response to that product?
To be honest, the response has been pretty tremendous. We launched with the largest law firm in the world just a few weeks ago, and we're currently being used by 8 of the top 100 firms in the United States.
That's excellent.
So in addition, we have about 50 other law firms that are currently using the software as well. So mm-hmm. For having just left beta in October, we feel like it's been a tremendous response. The market, I think, was really ready for a tool to help simplify the way firms get their lawyers sharing.
Well, while on the topic of your social media tool, what exactly does it do?
Well, to put it very simply, law firms create a lot of content, and they want their lawyers to share that content to the individual lawyer networks. But the only way to get them to do that is by getting the lawyers to opt in.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, before our software existed, the firm could send an email out, say, "Hey, you know, John Smith was quoted in the Wall Street Journal. Please copy this link, go over to LinkedIn, log in, go to the homepage, in the status update box, paste in the link, and hit share." And for lawyers like you and I, Ken, that are pretty tech savvy, that takes all of 20 seconds, and it's no big deal.
Sure.
Just do it.
Yes.
But for the average lawyer, I mean, I've seen it all. I taught a lawyer a few months ago. Been practicing for 60 years, and he did not know how to copy and paste.
Wow.
And it's funny, I explained it to him, and after he figured it out, he was like, "Wow, that's so easy. So that's what copy and paste is." Anyway, so you get the sense that there's a lot of lawyers that they're just not very tech savvy. So what our software does, it lets the marketing department send out an email that just has a button embedded in it. So all the lawyer has to do is open the email and click the share button, and it will share the article.
That's excellent. So it really makes the tools available and makes things, you know, easy to do in the social media space.
Yeah, and what we like to say is it decreases the activation energy that's required.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, rather than taking 20 seconds, they can just take 5 seconds and share it.
Sure.
And even though that's not a big difference, for a busy lawyer, it may be the difference between him sharing and not sharing.
And are there analytics behind it? Can law firms see, you know, how effective this is? Any tools like that?
Yeah, absolutely. So if you've used Bitly or Hootsuite before, every time you share, you can see how many clicks you've received and where and whether or not people are reading what you share.
Mm-hmm.
So our tool has those same analytics. The advantage, though, that it has over Hootsuite or Bitly is that you can not only see your analytics, you can see the analytics for everyone in your organization. And you can also see the analytics for the articles. So what are the most successful articles being shared in your organization? And because I believe that success this way can beget more success. So when you see someone share something that has just been a big hit, you can reshare that to your network knowing already people like it. It's being clicked on a lot when lawyer A shares it. So there's a good chance that if lawyer B shares it, it will also be successful. For those of you that are a little bit more advanced with analytics, you can even drill down and see the companies that have been clicking on the articles you share. So we actually do an IP lookup for every click that comes through. So you can see the name of the company, if they have a known named IP server. So large companies, educational institutions will have known IP addresses. Otherwise, we filtered out all of the junk results. So you're not going to see Time Warner, Comcast. You'll just see the big companies that are clicking. Mm-hmm. And so because we're integrated with LinkedIn, we can also show them who they know at the companies that have clicked on their article. So anyway, so some pretty exciting analytics. The firms that are using it right now have been thrilled with it. It's been very sticky. So once firms get lawyers started using it, they almost always want to continue.
Wow, that's really an amazing product. I think that there's going to be lots of firms, I bet, that'll be interested in seeing it and demoing it in the future. You know, a lot of our listeners are IP lawyers themselves. Are there things that you think about in the sense of what lawyers should be sharing on social media platforms, what they shouldn't be sharing? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, let's just start with the very basic question of why should lawyers share articles at all? And I know it may seem obvious to people like you and I that have been doing this for a while, but let's just step back and say, why should they share? Mm-hmm. And I think what you need to think back to is, you know, did you ever have, Ken, an old mentor that would cut out an article, put it in an envelope, put a stamp on it, and mail it to you? Did you ever have that
all the time? Yes. In fact, even a few weeks ago, I received it in the mail.
Yeah. And I mean, you think about how does it make you feel when someone picks out an article just for you and sends it to you?
Well, I think it shows that they're caring and that they're interested in your practice,
right?
You know?
That's right. It shows they care and they're thinking about you specifically.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, it is a small percentage of lawyers that take the time to show they care and to share articles with their most important contacts, right? They all should be doing it. But it's only the precious few that are doing that right now.
Yes.
And so at the very basic level, we share articles with an individual to show them we care, that we're thinking about them. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, when we share an article to LinkedIn, we're not sharing it just to one person. We're sharing it publicly to many people as an update. So it's put out there in a passive way for people to see.
Mm-hmm.
And while you don't get the same effect of showing, you know, personal touch, you know, that this one person cares about you, what you do see is, as an IP lawyer, you've got a pretty impressive body of knowledge, Ken, about what information is important to your clients. And when you read 20 articles and you pick the one that's most relevant and most important to the decision makers of companies, and you share that, that is valuable work product.
That's right.
Valuable information. And by you doing that, in a way, you're showing off. You're showing off. You're saying, this is important, you know, because of my knowledge, I know this is important. And if you read it, you'll see it's important. And the more you share, the more you do that and demonstrate that, it builds your reputation as someone that's really on top of the marketplace, top of what's happening.
Yeah, that's well said. And I assume your product allows the lawyers who are using it to get to that place.
Yeah, I mean, and that's the hope. And you don't need the software, obviously, Ken. I mean, I've seen you've done an amazing job of sharing over the years, mm-hmm. building your reputation and building an international reputation. I mean, I talked to IP lawyers, you know, I talked to an IP lawyer in Boston the other day, and I said, oh, do you know Ken Suzan? And he said, oh, you know, I don't know him well, but I see his tweets. You know?
Excellent.
And so you're connected into this global network that never would have known of you before.
Sure.
But, you know, now you're creating this cool content. So yeah, that's kind of the basic answer to your question. That's why you should care about sharing.
For sure. Now, let me ask you, lawyers have limited time. How can a lawyer be effective in social media? I mean, is there a magic number of hours or minutes that they should do it every day? What do you think about that point?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think by far the most important thing the lawyer can do is have a process. Okay. Everybody has the same hours in the day, but the difference between that separates the exceptionally successful people and the average people is process. Mm-hmm. And so I'm not going to tell you you have to spend an hour a day on social media, but I will tell you if you want to be successful, you've got to have a daily and a weekly process. Okay. For me, my process is very simple. In the morning and in the night, you know, kind of when I get to work, when I finish work, I spend about 15 minutes checking LinkedIn, checking Twitter, sharing an article, reading an article, commenting on something someone shared. And then one day a week, I sit down and I carve out time to write an article. Sure. So I create information and then I also participate. And that's my process. And I've seen a lot of lawyers start and stop using social media and they give up before they see any results. But then I've also seen lawyers that, that have brought in hundreds of thousands or even millions of dollars of business. And those lawyers all have a process that's locked in. So I don't care how much time you choose, but you've just got to have some time that you set aside every day and every week to make it happen.
Adrian, do you see any trends in 2015? You know, we're just a little bit away from the new year. Anything new that our listeners should be apprised of?
Yeah, you know, there's a bunch of new things. People always want to know what's the new social network, you know, and it's funny because for 6 years, people have been saying to me, what's going to replace Twitter? What's going to replace Facebook? What's going to replace LinkedIn? But here we are 6 years later, and all three of those are 10 times as big as they were 6 years ago, and they're not going anywhere. Those big three are sticking around. So, and there's other sites that matter, you know, Pinterest and Instagram and WhatsApp, but all these things matter. But the big trend I see coming is a trend in microsites. So lawyers are realizing that their online identity is very important and that they can't trust it to their law firm to completely create the online picture of who they are. You know, because a single bio sitting on a crowded website is not going to get attention. So I see the big trend being lawyers creating their own microsites to take ownership over their practice. And, you know, LinkedIn already gives you the ability to create a pretty cool microsite right on the page. As you know, now on LinkedIn, you can include PowerPoint presentations and interviews. I mean, my LinkedIn, as you've seen, you know, my LinkedIn profile, it's a multimedia presentation of who I am. It's got, you know, me being interviewed on Bloomberg Law. It has a picture of me giving a keynote in London. It has, you know, a PowerPoint slide of me speaking about how to use social media to reach general counsel.
Sure.
So you get, you know, and the microsites are going to do the same thing. It's going to be a very simple way to very quickly get a picture of who the lawyers are, why they're exceptional, and why they should be seriously considered for the legal challenge that businesses are facing. So that's a trend I see just kind of starting. I think it's going to get a lot bigger in 2015.
Excellent. Now, with respect to your page, it sounds like you're usually updating it from time to time. I assume that is that part of your program and plan?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and that's got to be part of the process. You know, I talk to a lot of lawyers where I say, because there's the two glaring things that are missing in partners' bios on LinkedIn. Number one, they're missing a picture. And number two, they're missing a summary. And then I ask them, I drill down, I say, well, what was the process you used to create that bio? Have you, your firm bio, you know, have you updated it in the last 3 months? Have you changed it? And I mean, I had one lawyer say to me, oh, well, 5 years ago when I joined the firm, I just looked at someone else's bio and I just kind of followed and wrote mine the same way they had written theirs.
Wow.
Like, well, that's a terrible way to strategically position yourself, right? And so I tell lawyers, you know, not only do they have to create a very thoughtful and strategic summary on LinkedIn, but they've got to update it regularly because they've got to stay on top of the latest issues, the latest things that are happening in their industry.
That's good, Adrian. Adrian, I know you're on top of all the latest apps and technologies. I'm curious, on your own smartphone, could you tell our listeners three apps that you regularly use or that other attorneys would find useful on their smartphones?
Yeah, sure, sure. You know, it's funny, when you asked this, when you said to me you're going to ask this question, I was like, well, do I tell them about Candy Crush? No, I'm just kidding. But I mean, I assume when you say which apps are the most useful, you're asking about, you know, from a business standpoint, what are your most useful apps?
Yes, yes.
And I'll tell you honestly that the apps that I get the most use out of, they might kind of surprise you. Okay, so the app that I find the most useful is Google's new Google Map app. Because the app gives me so much information. It shows me where things are. It gives me the phone number of the place. It gives me the link to the website. I know it's not very exciting to talk about, but the Google Map app is the most used app I have on my phone. Okay.
Excellent.
For social media, I think Hootsuite has a great app to track everything that's going on Twitter.
Okay, can you spell that for our listeners? Is that Hootsuite?
Yeah, Hootsuite is Hootsuite, kind of like Hoot, and then an office suite, so Hootsuite.com.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
It's a free download, and, you know, it's a great app. Now, another thing that may sound kind of surprising, and I know most lawyers are kind of closed-minded to this, but the other app that I get the most use out of is, surprisingly enough, is the Facebook app.
Okay.
So Facebook has changed so much over the last couple of years. They've figured out a way to get better and better at delivering to you just the types of information and the messages that you want to see. So it used to be I'd get on Facebook and I'd see all these people I barely knew from high school or college, and I'd see them posting all this dribble. Well, what Facebook has realized is they've used their software, so when you click on something in Facebook, Facebook remembers that. So they remember whose pictures you care about, who you comment on. And what they start to do is they're going to start filtering out the information you're not interested in.
Wow, so Facebook is becoming smarter and smarter as we go.
Yeah. And people say, like, oh, what's going to take over Facebook? Well, the truth is they've got such a huge advantage. Not only do they have the population, but they're not taking that population for granted. They're continually getting better, you know. And Twitter and LinkedIn are doing the same thing, probably not quite as quickly as Facebook. But if you used to be using Facebook, but you gave it up a couple of years ago because you got annoyed by all the meaningless stuff, you might want to try it out again because it really is great. And I'm seeing more business stuff there now than ever. There's a legal marketing group on Facebook that is currently the most active social media group in legal marketing across all the platforms, more than LinkedIn, more than Twitter, and it's on Facebook.
Great. Could you repeat that for us?
Well, it's called Legal Marketers Extraordinaire.
Okay, great.
I don't know who named it, but clearly they have some ego.
For sure. Adrian, how can people get in touch with you? I know you're always very busy and flying all throughout the country and the world. What's the best way for people to find you and communicate with you?
Yeah, the best place for people to start a conversation with me is on Twitter. So at Adrian Dayton is where they can find me, AdrianDayton, just like Dayton, Ohio.
Okay.
And I am a LinkedIn open networker, so please connect with me on LinkedIn. I'd love to have a conversation, and I'm always very open to meet anybody and hear about what you're doing and find out if there's people I can collaborate with.
Adrian, thanks so much for joining us today on our program.
Thank you, Ken. It was a thrill.
So if you want to know more about Adrian Dayton, go to www.ipfridays.com/Adrian, A-D-R-I-A-N. So also don't forget to leave a comment in the show notes or on any other section of the website, or leave us a voicemail at ipfridays.com/voicemail to win one of the Christmas mugs. We will ship them wherever you are.
That's it for this episode. If you like what you've heard, please show us your love by visiting ipfridays.com/love and tweet a link to this show. We would be so grateful if you would do that. It would help us out to get the word out. Also, Please subscribe to our podcast at ipfridays.com or on iTunes or Stitcher.com. If you have a question or want to be featured in one of the upcoming episodes, please send us your feedback at ipfridays.com/feedback. Also, please leave us a review on iTunes. You can go to ipfridays.com/iTunes, and it will take you right to the correct page on iTunes. If you want to get mentioned on this podcast or even have comments within the next episode, please leave us your voicemail at ipfridays.com/voicemail. Also, remember to submit feedback and participate in the chance to win a Christmas mug from Cologne, Germany. You have been listening to an episode of IP Fridays. The views expressed by the participants of this program are their own and do not represent the views of, nor are they endorsed by their respective law firms. None of the content should be considered legal advice. The IP Fridays podcast should not be construed as legal advice or legal opinion on any specific facts or circumstances. The contents of this podcast are intended for general informational purposes only, and you are urged to consult your own lawyer on any specific legal questions. As always, consult a lawyer or patent or trademark attorney. Copyright 2014, all rights reserved.